Well, it's always a special evening when you get a chance to hear Jane Wayne read. You don't get that chance that often. She enjoys a reputation as a poet's poet, because poets respect her work. She's the author of the collection Looking Both Ways, which was published by the University of Missouri Press and received the Devens Award for Poetry. And we do have copies of that book here that are available, along with Jason Summers' book and the current issues, most current issues of River Styx. Jane has received several other awards, including first prize for poetry from the St. Louis Poetry Center and the Wednesday Club of St. Louis. Her work has been published in numerous periodicals and anthologies. These include the Iowa Review, Plowshares, Poetry Northwest, and the Anthology of Missouri Women Writers. And most excitingly and most currently, a second collection of her poems, Revisions on a Postcard, has just received the Marion Moore Award Prize that's given out by Helicon 9 Publications for 1996 and will be published late spring, early summer by that press. So it's with a great deal of happiness that I'm able to say, now that we're tuned, let's listen to some poems by Jane Wayne.
Thank you, Michael. Hope I don't only read one note, something I was just saying I wanted to avoid doing. I'm going to read a little bit from my first book, I can say, and from my forthcoming book tonight. I'll probably jump back and forth trying to make connections between the poems. I was going to start out by reading something about the weather, but I was going between snow and springtime and. Here's a Monday poem I'll start with. The Knot. On Monday, after she strips the bed, she can hear the sheets sliding down the clothes chute, can feel the suction of the week whooshing from her hands. She knows how another morning can slip over her head, how mindlessly she can button up the front and thinly powdering the facts can let the frown pass in the mirror. No appetite, no zest. She's full of sameness, had enough of the bland diet of routine, its place set at her table, its black coffee in her cup. She keeps rubbing the ring out of the bathtub, peeling the same potato, changing the sheets. She can't change her life. The harder she pulls, the tighter the knot of habit. Well, maybe I'll read one for the weather forecast. We were supposed to have snow. Survivors. While we were sipping, slowly emptying our glasses, snow buried these streets. We could be the lone survivors, the last pulse of a beast that this midnight wind circles like a hawk. All the way home, I keep hearing hymns in the hum our trudging makes, on our white breath, the prayers, the chanting of our ancestors, their hopes fed on the same hard crusts we scattered to the birds. On our lawn, a tall birch boughs nearly to the ground. It blocks our way. We brush off the snow limb by limb to the whole tree whips the night in front of us, grazing our coats, missing our faces. I guess we're all interested in dreams, the unconscious. I find other people's dreams interesting. I have a walking partner in the morning, and we often trade our dreams. And this one is actually a steal from my daughter. Your recurring dream. Haven't you noticed there's often something you can't put away before you fall asleep? Like a necklace that won't unfasten or pull over your head? Something left undone that nags at you? A white slip of a thought half hanging out of a closed drawer? You dream the way you hold your blue jeans upside down, shaking them to get the day's loose change out of the pockets. If you had nightmares in the last century, you might have awakened tugging the reins of some runaway in an open field instead of clutching the steering wheel of your downhill dream, always speeding, always pushing the brakes through the floor of consciousness, night after night, belted into the same driver's seat, locked into a dream that never crashes. Analysis, anyone? Don't know what the dream means, but the same daughter inspired this one. This is even more mysterious than dreaming is the subject of this poem. Braiding your hair, that's not really the subject. Last night I found you walking in your sleep, stopping near the stairs, staring right at me. You answered someone in your dream, then went to bed. Now brushing the night out of your hair, I keep catching on knots, not your words, they're forgotten, but your face so fugitive, your eyes at point blank range, a stranger's, the mystery not just yours but mine, the day and night in all of us, your hair between my hands, your back to me, I separate the strands and braid them. Well, while we're on the subject of sleep, a related subject. Insomniac. Cares keep cropping up, helter-skelter as the wind-sown seedlings in his garden. All night he argues with the wind. He opens windows, then he closes them. He watches bubbles climb a glass of water. There is no rushing them. He sips slowly at the dark, but can't get it down. Silence keeps him sober. He listens. Maybe sleep will click and close him up, a jackknife in a firm hand. The day still spreads before him, an open map that is hard to fold on the right lines, hard to put away. But how easily she sleeps beside him. She steps out of a day like a dress and drops it on the floor. The next piece I'll read was written some years ago, which should dispel any notion of its being autobiographical. It's entitled Facing Widowhood. It really was. I've only been a widow for 3 years, and this was written 13 years ago. Maybe. Facing Widowhood. Someone has drawn a shade in my neighbor's window. I listen to the radio for news. The same drought, the same slow damage in the distant fields. Nothing changes my mind. I pour tea and wait. Slowly the cloud passes over the cup. There is no detour. I can't climb carefully to silence the steps. The old boards sing when I least expect, never the same song twice. Lately, I've been writing poems that are interconnected in a way, or they're thematically, they're on the same subject, and so this is kind of new for me. Tonight, I think I'll read four in a series, if series is the right word. These four were inspired by my late husband's heart transplant, and these four in particular he liked, so I'd like to read them in his memory. There are a lot of his friends here tonight. Going in for tests. In a glass cubicle, someone takes your name and your address. Then at the bottom of the page, you sign your life away. Someone else behind a desk has your number, bands your wrist like a pigeon's leg, but you're not flying off. Your shoes, your street clothes gone. You match the walls in your pale uniform. You surrender to the bed, the lone inmate in this boxcar of a room. Door closed, train in motion. On this trip, there's no turning back, no way around the sentry at the gate who signals those ahead of you, thumbs up or down, as if he's just directing traffic. All night, you're getting closer. On your left side, the guard dog snarls. As in every new field, and the transplant field too has its own new terminology, and one is taken aback from time to time by the lexicon. For example, harvesting is the term used for, maybe that's commonplace by now, it's still, it's a term for recovering organs from the newly dead. Or when a heart patient finally qualifies, becomes well enough, sick enough, well enough, it has to be both, for an organ, the patient then goes into the computer, and that's called being, if it's a heart, on the heart list. I'll say the next poem is on the heart list, but just as a little bit of a introduction, for those of you who, most of you know, Judith is the heroine who decapitated Holofernes, and who was the Assyrian, the enemy of the Jews. But her mention here is not political, it's really for the violence of the act. And there's this really strange thing when you're waiting for an organ, it means someone else has to die, so you're wishing, you're not wishing, you're frozen in between. You don't want death, but you know that's inevitable. And occasionally you think, you know, I can't make that wish. It's, you know, it will be like the golden touch. It'll turn against you, and you can easily think of how it could turn against you. One weekend, my daughter was on the highway coming home from the university, and so that, the poem. On the heart list. He's sound asleep, mesmerized by pumping, so he doesn't know what heartless means. How like a crow it hovers single-mindedly, waiting for someone else's loss. How always on alert, its wife sleeps near the telephone, twists and tangles in her sheets, and all night dreams of crashes, dreams by accident. The heart that saves him is his daughter's. He doesn't know how much she fears the nightmare, like some Judith rising up in her, sword in hand, how even in the daylight she fears the dark, the wrong head severed on the sand. Waking up. What else fell when the shears snapped around the flower stem? In the sheets, the smell of loss lingers medicinal and sharp as the antiseptic on a cut. This must be what an addict feels under his tongue, his fingernails. No detour, nothing to chew on. Everything is different now. With the curtains closed, I can't tell the morning from the night, the ocean from an empty shell. A whole spring and summer in this cubicle, like a winter coat in a closet. To my own flesh, then, I'm a revenant. Or is this someone else's dream that I've stumbled into, the way a drunk enters the wrong house in the dark? If I could, I'd roll over into the cooler place in bed. Or should I pretend it's home, the room inside the mirror on the wall where everything is backward, where I'm a distant rumor of myself? Tubes, like parasitic vines, dangle from my mouth and limbs. They're trying to win me over. This one has a reference to an Irish myth that if you fall asleep under an elder tree, it causes madness. Ever hear of it, my Irish authority? It's probably very arcane, but anyway, it sort of caught me. Anesthesia. How dark the water was. When I dipped the oars, their pale hands disappeared. I must have lost a year of nights drifting on that lake. While I slept, I might have been the cortex in a tree, the bark around me toughening, the wooden circles widening their grasp. I might have been enchanted in my bed, might have let them steal my heart and leave another. What really happened? Did I fall asleep under an elder tree? Or is this the madness of a strange heart pounding in my chest? And in what forest of imagination am I sleeping now? Oh, for years I hated, I don't hate it so much anymore. I hated being interrupted when I was writing. But this poem arises out of one of those fortuitous interruptions. Someone was at the door and when I was writing. And I'll read a few of these poems that are, I think of them as portraits, but they're, looking outside, looking inside, they're portraits. They're portraits, they're not landscapes. They're not interior things exclusively. The summons. What led her to my street, this weathered crone? And why choose my stoop in the rain? Why my screen door to sift her words? She won't come in. Look at her waiting for me, her crinkled cheeks, her hair grizzled and uncombed. She's all purpose on the porch. She doesn't beg so much as beckon through the screen, her sparrow eyes flitting the whole time. Our fates know our faces. They can single us out in a crowd, the way a wolf separates the straggler from the herd. They follow us home. This one at the door travels light, a plastic bag for a hat, another for a poncho. She's found my house, found me, as a hermit crab finds an empty mollusk shell. She's not my size yet, but she persists. I can see her stratagem. She doesn't want my empty clothes. She wants me to cross her threshold. This is a kind of a celebration or praise of collectors, or really compulsive savers, to put it in less exalted language. And the title, Horror Vacui, means an aversion to empty spaces. It's an art term where you really fill up the canvas or whatever you have available to you to fill up. And it has a little epigraph. Horror vacui. No nation whose nursemaids were so prolific with hairpins could survive. Emil Zola on noting hairpins beneath a bench in Hyde Park. Against some peripety, some vague, unspoken dread, she saves old clothes, old letters, paper bags and paper clips, rubber bands, corks, lids without jars, jars without lids, until every drawer is stuffed, every closet and shelf crammed from top to bottom, the whole house full of collections like a mind with too much on it. She cannot discard anything without vacillating, a torn sheet, a bent bobby pin, or these black shoes she hasn't worn for years, the heels scuffed, the toes chipped and peeled like fingernails that need repolishing. Each time she passes them in the wastebasket, she can't resist looking in, craning the way a curious viewer does over a casket. Oh, this one, I suppose, was inspired by that very sad period of time when we went from using individual garbage cans to dumpsters, those communal, impersonal refuse collectors. The trespasser. One slit half-twisted in these blinds, and I can see him out there in the alley, reading through all my trash, my old shoes, my empty envelopes, a bare-boned fish. My thick hedge can't keep him out. He reads right through it to my dandelions, my uncut grass. If I'm not careful, he'll get in the house, brazen past me like a spider on a houseplant. In my sitting room, he'll find the white scars glasses leave on all the tables, and that pale square hanging on the wall. He won't stop there. He'll read my favorite chair, like the lines in my palm, and on my face, dark thoughts surfacing, as clothes do in a tub of water. But I won't talk. So what if he ransacks every closet and empties drawers onto the floor? Shake me, turn me inside out like some old sock. I won't yield. Well, In small rooms, where the aunts are waiting to join the uncles, they keep all the windows closed and their valises ready in the closet, like boxes stacked with empty boxes. When they stop finger drumming on the table, they can hear the darkness ripening through the avocado skin and the uncles whispering out of photographs, beckoning to them like faces in water. But when you visit those tight rooms, they don't mention it. They wear confinement like a ring that won't pull off. One hand warming on a cup, they drift, stirring the past slowly through the conversation, as if they're only stirring sugar. Then abruptly, as a piece of cake tumbles from a fork, they let it drop. Each morning, in a row of saucers on the windowsill, they water fur-leafed violets faithfully as you would a cat. And over their skew-balled chairs, they drape the silk shawl of better times. And who, in such a low-ceilinged room, wouldn't watch the only open door? Who wouldn't bend a little toward the mirror each night, getting closer to the truth? Keeping an eye on it as a guard does a shifty prisoner. All it takes is a wind, a mere sigh, to lock us out of the house. This one is part of a new series. I'll just read a couple from that series. From a half-filled cup. When he left last night, as quickly as he kissed me on the cheek, some numbness settled over me, like a cover on a drowsy child, until this morning when I cleared the dishes from the dinner table. His half-filled cup must have brought the evening back, must have held him like some spirit in a magic lamp. So when I touched the rim, my finger circling the way a child rubs a crystal glass to bring the hidden music out, I thought about his lips, his saliva in the milky dregs. And before I carried it to the sink to pour it out, for a moment, only for a moment, I thought of drinking those cold dregs, of drinking more than what he hadn't, and of the odd desire to take that fluid's darkness on my tongue, a kind of kiss, but darker. This one's very short, so listen shortly. Watermark. In the heat, I have no answer to your letter. The ice melts in my lemonade. The glass sweats on the paper. Your ink is wet again. Your dark words blur. They turn the puddle on the stationery, bruise blue. The wet circle slowly blisters. It dries but doesn't heal. I guess I think, sometimes I think if I were in solitary confinement, you know, what would I be able to hear? What would I be able to see? My daughter and I were arguing about the color of my mother's eyes, but it isn't just seeing, it's hearing too. What can we hear in here? Revenant. Like a dream noise that wakes you in the night and makes the house quieter, it's in the air again, a certain throatiness, a fluttering. Her voice calling, the way groundwater pulls the dowser's hazel wand. And you want to yell out to her. You want to open a window that's painted shut, as if you could catch her on that lawn, could take her by surprise, like a cat pouncing on a bird. She won't hold still. Her laugh flickers through the quiet house, the off and on of music tantalizing on a car radio, some distant station you keep losing. But which is worse, forgetting or remembering? Under your breath, you try rummaging among the scales for her, as if you could find the right pitch, the right melody, as if you could hum her to yourself. I'm sort of losing track of time. I think I'll just read one more. Does that sound right? More than that? You don't want to read more, Jason? Okay, I'll read two more, three more. Jason, we've got a little sign signaling going here. All right. I'll read these really quickly. In the runaway's house. She left her bicycle on its side, the gray fur of the basement growing on the spokes, the kickstand in the air. But you keep finding her, the way you come upon a coin or pen lodged between the cushions of a chair. Go ahead, hang new curtains in her bedroom, but you won't break off this thread between your teeth. You can paint the walls a different color and empty the drawers and shelves, but you can't close the door to this room. No matter what you do, she keeps taking you by surprise, like the metal hangers jangling in her closet. Whenever the phone rings or the doorbell, you can see her long hair and tinted glasses, can hear the silk ruffle of her voice. She's unchanged, the same smile, the same shirt and faded jeans she left in 15 years ago. Sometimes from the hall, you even see her at the dressing table, her back to you, her left hand brushing out her hair, while like Perseus, she is looking at you in the mirror. She'll never get the knots out, never change. She's fastened in your mind, like a photograph in your album, or lines in a letter that you've read too many times. That girl never came back. That's not my daughter, by the way. I'll read the title poem from my forthcoming book, and then I'll leave on two more poems. Revisions on a Postcard. It's that day again. The wooden table near the road, the thick socks, the worn trousers tucked into hiking boots, and I want to erase my fears like a dull entry in a journal. I want to get up from that terrace table where we sat in the sun late one afternoon writing postcards, this time over the empty plates and cups, the beer-stained mugs. I want to shake the map wide open on the afternoon and leave all the unpaid bills behind, that longing at the edge of town like the weight of a backpack that won't stop pulling. Before it's too late, I want to follow the hiker who got off the bus, slung his pack over his shoulders, mid-stride and without once looking back, left the village on the hill road. The place in this Perdiguier-O is in the south of France, Languedoc, to be specific. Bedtime Perdiguier-O. When we moved to the house on the hill with the abandoned winery, the thick stone walls, the room-sized wooden casks, no one warned us that if someone knocks on a cask, the spirit of the cave awakens in the splashing. Some nights we sit outside till 10, when an owl that we've never seen cries out from the micoculio tree near the house, as if to signal us home. And who says that daytime is the waking time? Lights out, the shutters closed. I lie in bed, enchanted, like the wine sealed in its cask. Surely what we can see must be the lesser part of what we know. In the dark, I try to imagine the dreams of the blind, the wine inside those casks as blue as blood before it mixes with the air. I walk about strange continents at night, the possibilities spread out like so many stars. Thank you.